A new concern about cannabis use.
Are new and improved artificial hips and joints really an improvement?
Yet another indication for aspirin.
And use of questionable medications in people with advanced dementia.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on September 12th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center at El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think if you don't mind, we'll start this week with something I served up as, another concern about cannabis use. That's the use of cannabis in adolescence, as published in Lancet Psychiatry, some concerns about how it might impact teenagers.
Over the last several years, we've had a marked shift in our attitude towards the use of cannabis or marijuana. And we've noticed that adolescents are initiating cannabis use earlier than in previous years. In England, about 4% of kids 11 to 15 year olds have used cannabis in the last month. In the United States, about 7% of U.S. high school seniors are daily or near daily cannabis users. And in Australia, 4% of high school teenagers use it weekly. And the question is, does the use of cannabis cause difficulties later in life? And to address that, investigators integrated data from three large, long-running, longitudinal studies that were conducted in Australia and New Zealand. And they investigated the association between maximum frequency of cannabis use before the age of 17 and several developmental outcomes. Did they complete high school? Did they attain a university degree? Did they subsequently end up having cannabis dependence? Did they use other illicit drugs? Were there suicide attempts, depression, or welfare dependence? There was a large number of individuals in the study. Between the three studies, ranged between 2,500 and almost 3,800 individuals, followed up until age 30. There was a clear and consistent association and actually a dose-response relationship between the frequency of cannabis use as an adolescent and all of the adverse adult outcomes that I mentioned.
Clearly something that we really need to be concerned about as we're decriminalizing marijuana in this country and increasing its availability. I guess this points to a couple questions for me or observations. One of them is we know that there's that profound period of neuronal sprouting in late teenage years and the early 20s, then they'll start pruning those things back. So the presence then of cannabis metabolites, I guess at that point, could be especially problematic. I guess the other question I would ask is, well, all right, who's drawn to the use of cannabis, and were these already people who may have been at risk?
That's a great question. Is it a cause or the effect? What you can say is the following. It appears to be a true association because there is a dose relationship. They tried to control for many different confounding variables. In fact, 53 different things. And even when they adjust for these, there still continues to be a clear association. And it wasn't an association between one adverse outcome and cannabis. It was for all of them. So the data appear to be fairly robust.
I think we know from other things like alcohol, that probably at that point in somebody's lifetime, that's not really a great time to have too much exposure to it. So to me, it makes sense to try to improve constraints on the use of this and also to do screening for it to try to say, hey, you know, right now, maybe this isn't the best choice.
And that's one of the points that the authors make. We really need to have significant, substantial efforts to reform cannabis legislation to keep it out of the hands of adolescents where it can substantially affect neuronal development and subsequent psychological development as well.
All right, and we'll be watching. So since we're talking about neuronal development, then let's go to the other end of the spectrum. In JAMA Internal Medicine, a look at the continuation of the use of medications when people have profound dementia.
When we talk about profound or advanced dementia, we're talking about individuals that have a terminal illness. They're usually going to die within 1 to 2 years. They have severe cognitive dysfunction. They don't no longer recognize family members, bedridden, and they have minimal verbal abilities. Yet they receive an average of 5 to 15 medications daily. So what this study attempted to address was, what is the use of medications of questionable benefit in people with advanced dementia? Because our goals for these individuals should be very different. It's not to prevent the long-term complications of diabetes or high cholesterol or even hypertension. Our goal should be to minimize interventions that are of questionable benefit and actually to provide more comfort care. So these investigators looked at over 5,400 nursing home residents that all had advanced dementia, and they had access to their pharmacy records. And what they discovered was that over half of them received at least one medication with questionable benefit. The more common medications were those that were usually used to treat dementia, which, by the way, are most effective in the early phases, not in the late phases, and also statin medications. They went a step further and said, okay, well, if over half of individuals are receiving medications that are of questionable benefit, what's the cost associated with it? What they discovered was that the 90-day expenditure of these questionable benefit medications was $816. In fact, it accounted for about a third of the total average of their 90-day medication expenditures.
Clearly, these are things that need to be scrutinized, and we need to look at if we're going to have an impact on somebody's condition and eliminate those medications that are not going to be helpful.
Not only they're not helpful, but we know that the more medications one has, the more likely there is to be some adverse drug reaction and interaction between them. And we know these medications sometimes contribute to the increased morbidity, falls, worsening dementia. So this is an opportunity to save money, to improve care, to decrease adverse events.
And I guess I would just remind family members also that they can scrutinize this medication list and say, hey, you know, is it really necessary for my loved one to continue to take this stuff?
Yeah, because this was directed toward nursing home residents, but we have many people with advanced dementia staying at home as well. So this is an opportunity, as you said, for caregivers to ask the doctor, do we really need to take this medication or not?
Excellent. Talking about medications we do need to take then, we'll move now to Annals of Internal Medicine as I served up another indication for aspirin.
And this particular indication is the use to prevent preeclampsia, which is one of the most serious health problems affecting pregnant women. It's a complication in about 1 in 20 pregnancies worldwide, and it contributes not only to maternal mortality, but also infant morbidity and mortality as well. Preeclampsia is a disorder that's characterized by the sudden onset of high blood pressure and filling of protein in the urine. It usually occurs during the second half of pregnancy. The question is, can we prevent it by using low-dose aspirin? The U.S. Preventative Services Task Force reviewed all the available literature. For women that are at high risk for preeclampsia, those that have had it before, those that have multi-fetal gestation, chronic high blood pressure, or diabetes, or kidney disease, or an autoimmune disease, these are individuals that have a high risk of developing it. And if they take low-dose aspirin, they can reduce the risk for preeclampsia by about 24%, for preterm birth by about 14%, and decrease intrauterine growth retardation, that is a small baby at birth, by 20%.
This is a significant benefit, of course, as we look over populations. I'm just wondering about individual women who are being assessed for whether they should be taking aspirin during pregnancy.
That's why I mentioned the high-risk features, and the USPSTF recommends that women with any of these high-risk features take low-dose aspirin between the weeks of 12 and 28 weeks of gestation.
Well, it seems pretty simple to me, so along with those prenatal vitamins, maybe be taking aspirin as well if it's indicated. Finally, then, let's turn to the British Medical Journal, a look at new hip and knee prostheses. Are they really worth it?
In the medical field, we have advances both in drug therapy and in medical devices, and they differ somewhat because if I gave you a prescription for a medication and then changed that, you would demand that we do additional studies to prove that that medication is just as safe and as effective as the parent medication. Medical devices are somewhat different. Once a medical device has been approved as being safe and effective by the FDA, then if there are improvements in that medical device, then that new device can be approved as being substantially equivalent without undergoing significant studies. That became an issue with the FDA because recently some of the hips, what are called metal-on-metal hips, several hundred thousands of which were implanted, have failed. So the FDA asked, well, what about the other new hips and knees that are on the market? So this was a systematic review of the literature and registry data where they looked at observational studies and randomized control trials and registry data of five of the most commonly used new hips and knee joints. Over 15,000 implants in over 13,000 patients, they had comparison with 1.2 million of the older joints. Of the five new and improved prosthetic joints, none of them were any improvements. They were neither any safer nor any better. I give kudos to the authors on this particular article. Just because something is out there and new and advertised as improved, it may not necessarily be an improvement. They say, well, what do we do with this information? Well, the first is that we need to be honest with our patients and say we may have limited data on this particular joint. I think it behooves us to do registry information. These things can be put in a small number of individuals, and then we need to follow the larger population that receives these for a longer period of time.
I like these ideas a lot. I think this is an area that is absolutely in need of transparency because, at least as I understand it, certain surgeons like certain prostheses the best and they're accustomed to implanting those, so they'll use them. But in the absence of any data like this that might help to inform those decisions up front.
Yeah, Elizabeth, as you know, I sit on one of the FDA panels that's responsible for approving circulatory devices. We're very interested in making sure that once a device is approved as new, or if it is substantially equivalent to a previous device, is that we have long-term registry data to inform us about whether it is an improvement, whether it is safe, whether it is effective.
Well, I think particularly in this venue where there are so many of us aging into the place where we're going to need hips and knees, this is something I hope at least we're going to see more study on. On that note, I will reveal that, of course, I'm going to do the cannabis use in adolescents this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.